Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Lob podcast with These Football Times. We are in the centre circle again, discussing all things Ireland and Irish football, and a great new book coming very soon, or in fact out already, I think, on that very topic. Before we get to the author in just 2 secs, I've also got Matthew Gibbs from the TFT gang along for the ride with me tonight. Evening, Matthew.
Evening, Aidan. Ready to get stuck in?
Good, good, good. And okay, this is the third book from friend of the podcast, his third appearance, I guess, for each of his books, and a serial author now, we have to call him, Chris Lee, host of Outside Right podcast. I'm sure many people are aware of that blog and podcast. And he's been kind enough to host various TFT writers on there from time to time. And we are more than delighted to have you back again, Chris. How are you?
Brilliant. Thank you. Yeah, thanks so much. In fact, Stephen Scragg holds the joint record for the most appearances on on the Outside Right podcast with 4. So it very much depends on how many books you guys can get out as to how many times you appear on my podcast.
Excellent. Well, this is, like I say, the hat trick for you, the third one after Origin Stories and The Defiant, on various historical aspects of football, of course, more globally in both of those cases, where in this case you've narrowed the focus to one particular country, one particular football culture. So first of all, I guess to kick us off then, Chris, if you'd tell us about the book, what it's all about, rather than just simply Irish football as I've pitched it so far, and why you chose that topic.
Yeah, fair enough. No, thank you for having me on. The book is called Shades of Green, A Journey into Irish Football, and it is very much me discovering Irish football as an outsider. So I'm not, as you can tell, I'm not Irish. I don't really have a connection with the place. But what I did notice from my own traffic and from a visit that I made a couple of years ago is that it's very, very fascinating football culture that often flies under the radar in terms of global appeal, etc., and attention. Yet it is having a moment, especially the League of Ireland, which is in the Republic of Ireland, and there's an awful lot of housekeeping we have to do about the whole politics and history, but which I'm sure we'll go through it as we go. But like, as you mentioned, my first two books, one was Origin Stories, which is a country-by-country case, examination of how the game got started in rough chronological order, and obviously there's a chapter on Ireland there, and that first exposed me to what is effectively the fourth oldest football culture in the world. And then my second one was The Defiant, History of Football Against Fascism, so you can tell I'm really interested in the political side of things. So when you look at a country like, or I say a geography like Ireland, you are talking and mixing those two things up, really deep history and a really quite intense at times political situation, which, and interesting about football as opposed to other sports, football really reflects the political history of the island as well. So you think about GAA, so Gaelic Athletic Association, games like Gaelic football and hurling, cricket and rugby, as two other imported games. They are administered as an all-island affair, whereas soccer isn't. And I can just use the word soccer because it's not the leading football code in Ireland as Gaelic football is. So divisive word for some people, but I'm going to say it to help separate the association rule of game from the Gaelic football. It has all that, and it does, like I said, it reflects the history. It's having a moment. So the League of Ireland at the minute has had its record cup attendance, about 43,000, I think it was, a couple of years ago. They used the Aviva Stadium again, which was, used to be Lansdowne Road, for the league season opener this year. Curtain Raiser, which between Bohemians and Shamrock Rovers, which is the big rivalry in Dublin. That had a record league crowd as well, 33,000. And there's a couple of other reasons that I chose to focus on Ireland, the island of Ireland, is that we've seen, growing up in England watching football, we had the Taylor Report in 1990 in following Hillsborough, obviously, and also there's other terrible sort of stadium tragedies in the 80s, such as the Bradford City Fire, for example. So stadiums kind of went through a big, kind of underwent redevelopment. Some got knocked down altogether, so we lost some amazing grounds, didn't we? Like the baseball ground, like, you know, Highfield Road. We're going to lose Goodison at the end of the season. Griffin Park, you know. So there's a whole load of little famous old grounds that went, and with them, quite often they're in the heart of a community. So it's nothing like walking down Red Brick Terrace and seeing some, like, you know, floodlights coming out. So it's all part of the ritual. And then someone all-seater obviously sees the Premier League was like becoming this global product. But what you get when you go to Ireland is that sense of familiarity in terms of the aesthetic, but the stadiums are still quite old school. And so, like, for example, the Oval in Belfast, which is the home of Glentoran, which is like some groundhoppers put down as their ultimate go-to place. It hasn't changed really since the 1950s when it was kind of renovated after World War II. Daly Mount, which is the home of Bohemians in Dublin, which is just absolutely brilliant. It's got these rusty floodlights. Some of it's condemned. So it's like, it's that's changing. It's getting a complete refit and actually even, you know, being turned around 90 degrees. At the end of the season, so the end of this year, calendar year. So there's that reason I like the old school grounds. And then finally, I like the idea of single geography books. So you've got things like Angels with Dirty Faces by Jonathan Wilson about Argentina. You've got John Foote's Calcio, which is one of the best books on Italy. You've got Ulle Hesse's book on Tor on Germany, Morbo by Phil Ball on Spain. And Ireland hadn't been done. There's a big canon, a really good canon of local Irish work around the country, but they cover, you know, individual topics like the soccer split, so that, you know, when Northern Ireland and the Republic kind of as nations and football as well went their own way. And there's various others, like one on Belfast Celtic, for example, which is a great football club from Belfast that disappeared. But, you know, I thought it'd be worth coming out with an outside perspective, having a travel around, so part groundhop, which is one of my hobbies, discovering a new country and new culture effectively, and also the history that goes with it, try and tell those stories. Now, I had to be careful, obviously, with that as well, especially being English going over there doing that. So I only, you know, if anything in there is a matter of historical record, and I interview someone from each club. That could be podcasters, historians, there's politicians in there, there's all sorts of different characters I speak to from each club. So they tell me the story, I effectively curate it, and you only really hear my voice when I'm sort of talking about my own personal experience.
Oh, fantastic. I mean, that, Matthew, what it sort of echoes to there when Chris is talking about some of the grounds and what has changed in the English game that maybe hasn't in the Irish game. It's a bit of the soul maybe that we've lost or are losing in the process of the chase of the cash and all of that, whereas in Ireland seems to be a little more in touch, from what Chris is saying there and from what comes through in his book, in touch with the roots.
You know, this is I read the book, which is a great book, by the way, Chris. It's a good deep dive into a really, like you say, a really fascinating football history. But one of the notes I made when I was reading through the book is that while some of the stadiums are clearly sort of a bit more old school, a bit more give that 90s vibe, it remains authentic and like a real old school football experience. And this is something I wrote these notes down, and this is something that Chris mentions in his conclusion at the end of the book, is that it's this authenticity, this authentic football experience that is being lost in, particularly in England, with the, you know, the word cannibalized is used a lot by some of the Irish voices featured in the book, and that's exactly what the Premier League is doing, is cannibalizing football into this. Well, I mean, you've mentioned Goodison, which is a perfect example. You're leaving this old ground with like hundreds of years of history to go move into a sort of soulless bowl that, I don't know, to me, that's a shame. You're not getting the more money that is being pumped into the game means there's more distance between the clubs and the communities where they're built. And you are sort of losing that sort of connection in the game. And I think that sort of thing is really sort of on show in Ireland currently, which I think is what makes it a really fascinating football scene at the minute, especially what's happened in the last year with the crazy title race they've had with Damien Duff and Shelbourne. It's been really fascinating to watch from afar.
The thing is, with the stadiums, it's not always their choice. No. Lack of funding and things like that. Only funding has only recently sort of become available, actually, for some of the things. So the only really new stadium in the Republic of Ireland, especially, is like Tallaght, for example. And even that has its challenges. I've been there when it was, but, you know, games have been called off for snow and they had called off for rain not so long ago. So weather is a big challenge that I'm sure we'll come to, actually, when we talk about, you know, challenges in the game. But I mean, the case of Casement Park, which was meant to be earmarked for its potential ground for Euro 2028, didn't, you know, that's not going to happen now by the looks of it. So it's kind of like, this is just goes to show that it's not you know, this fact that there's old school stadiums there isn't always a good thing. But what I would say is it's now getting loads more attention and the fans are getting far more active. And so, yes, they still have this really great connection with their local community, especially some of the sort of one city clubs like, you know, Cork, for example, Drogheda, Dundalk. But I just hope while things do improve and I hope they do get funding, but I just hope they maintain that kind of sentiment. Because a lot of them, there used to be a lot more fan-owned clubs. Now they think there's only a handful, like three or four.
Well, I was going to ask this, Chris, of what you think the future might be. You know, you've chronicled visits and issues around some of these terrific stadiums and the clubs who inhabit them. But as you say, if these are dating back to the post-war years and very little has changed since then, if, and as you rightly say, League of Ireland has been gaining extra focus lately, probably with, you know, big names being involved. Matthew mentioned Damien Duff and so on. That draws attention, but that draws appeal as well. And that ultimately, I guess, results in events like you talked about of the opening of the season in the Aviva, in the Republic of Ireland. In Northern Ireland too, I guess it's not on quite the same scale, but I think there's been sort of inroads in European competition as well. Will things change? Will we lose, you talk of the Oval of Glentoran, some of these, or Solitude, which club is that? Whoa. It's another, I love the name of that stadium, yeah. By the way, Cliftonville.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, places like this, which have a certain mystique about them to those of us who aren't from Ireland, I guess. Will they get lost at some point?
I hope not, but the thing is, like, there's always talk of things changing and then ultimately they don't really. But if you two and two you talk to, because some people, groundhoppers love the Oval, for example, but away fans, if you put on social media about how much you love the Oval, you'll have away fans come at you hard, going like, well, you have to stand there and, you know, inadequate facilities and that sort of thing. So yeah, I mean, that happened a number of times. I was like, oh, I love these old school grounds, and then people would go, you don't have to put up with them day in, day out, you know, week in, week out, I should say. So there is obviously frustration on the ground about that, especially those who travel possibly to the Premier League, which a lot of people do, and then they see that sort of top-notch facilities are there. But I think the balance lies somewhere in between, really, where you can modernize without losing, you know, we'll learn the lessons of the Premier League, so to speak. I don't think it'll ever be the same. You know, I think the League of Ireland is 31st ranked at UEFA at the minute, and NIFL or Irish League in Northern Ireland is about 45th. So their potential ceiling isn't, yes, there's room to grow, but they're not going to be ever like the biggest, you know, leagues in Europe, really. They're not being flush with cash, really. I think the question is how they make sure they get the right owners in that care about it and manage the clubs properly and make the most of the potential that they do have.
No, interesting. Yes, we shall see. Now, I guess when it comes to Irish football, and you've alluded to it already, Chris, is the split that happened in the country itself in the 1920s. I have to confess to my own ignorance here, and maybe we can blame the English school system also, that Irish history gets taught well in Ireland, I'm sure, but not so well in the UK, in Britain. And while we know certain elements of it, we don't appreciate the full context. And as a child growing up in the late 70s, early 80s and so on, what do you think of? You think of the Troubles, you think of clashes, but you also think of, well, they were two separate entities anyway. You don't necessarily get to the starting point quite so easily of all of that. But obviously, yes, its impact goes into many areas far more significant than football. But it is interesting, like you talked about at the start, how we have an Ireland team in rugby. Gaelic football is across the island in its entirety, whereas football is totally different. Soccer, mm-hmm. as you say, yeah. is totally different.
Association football, yeah.
Because I guess so some of that comes into popularity. You know, rugby isn't quite as global as soccer, and therefore equally the history of where federations began. I think you talk about how the Irish Football Association, which is now Northern Ireland, was actually the one that governed the whole thing. And if that then shrinks to being Belfast and Ulster, then it's not going to be, it's not going to quite cover everything anymore. And politically things need to change. You know, the split, I think, before we get on to international stuff, in terms of clubs though, you mentioned Belfast Celtic, and there's Derry, who obviously is playing Londonderry as the Northern Irish would. Well, some Northern Irish, let's be careful here. Some would refer to it, and Derry as others would refer to it, but it's geographically within Northern Ireland. but plays in the Republic of Ireland League, political, religious, and all sorts of reasons behind all of that. But it's these fascinating cases, and they're probably the two most prominent. But it's the fascination of a political situation from more than a century ago, or around about a century ago, is still being seen in footballing events today.
Yeah, I should probably give you the abridged version of where football and history fits in, because football, as well, I'll say soccer, association football, arrives in Ireland in the 1870s. Some say before, as it's sort of often kickabout between British garrison teams. So the reason there's garrisons in Ireland is Ireland's part of the UK at this point, the whole of Ireland, I should say. Now, in the 1870s, you've got a growing nationalist movement. You're looking at 700 odd plus years of English involvement in there since the Norman times. And then most significantly in the sort of late 17th century, you have a thing called the Ulster Plantation with lots of English. And then by this point, Scots as well. Protestants come and are given land taken from locals, Catholic population in the north, which comes back to population imbalance as comes to lead to the split. Ultimately, a couple of centuries later, now by the 1870s, also it's 20 years after An Gortamore, More, the Great Hunger, the famine, which has either killed or forced to emigrate most of the about half the population. It's millions of people we're talking about here. So it's a country still recovering from that in many ways, and seeing increased urbanisation. So in 1870, a guy called John MacCready MacAlery goes to Edinburgh. He's a Protestant from Belfast. He sees a football match, really likes what he sees, brings it back. He's already formed the Clifton. He's been involved with the Cliftonville Cricket Club. He forms Cliftonville Football Club, Association Football Club, and also he forms the IFA. Now, the interesting thing about the fact that he forms Cliftonville in 1879 is that the Irish diaspora in Scotland, where football's already more advanced, have formed Hibernian already in 1875. So Irishmen abroad are already forming football clubs before Irishmen at home, which is interesting. So still one island at this point within the UK. So what happens as you grow the growing nationalist movement, the Gaelic Athletic Association is formed in 1884 to protect national sports like Gaelic football, like hurling, and a couple of other sports against what they call garrison games or foreign games that are brought in from from the Brits, so to speak. So this is where sort of there's quite a lot of, you can already see the sport and nationalism and identity is becoming kind of entwined in this late period. Now, you fast forward to the sort of 1912, this nationalist movement got to the point so much that they're discussing the Home Rule Bill in Westminster. The Ulster Protestants don't like the idea of there being a majority rule in Dublin, run by Catholic majority, and they're sort of fearing a backlash. So they start arming themselves. You get volunteer groups being formed, guns coming in. The only thing that stops the UK from having a civil war at this point is that World War I breaks out in 1914. So everyone has a kind of common enemy, so to speak. Now, in Britain, there was conscription, and in Ireland, there wasn't. So they actually volunteered from both sides, Protestant and Catholic. And they both expected a payback from the British government at the end of it. And of course, as you probably know, and a lot of your listeners know, in 1916, some nationalists couldn't wait, and they just announced their own republic in the Easter Uprising in 1916. This is quashed rather brutally and swiftly. But it's not so much the uprising that has support, it's the more the uprising gets support once the British government starts executing the protagonists. So it's the treatment of the prisoners rather than the actual uprising itself that gains support and turns against the British. Now, by the end of the war, obviously, focus comes back to Ireland and the War for Independence begins. Now, what happens is this result, we'll cut a long story short, the Protestant majority north decide that they want to keep, or would like to have their own, remain within the United Kingdom. So six counties of the nine within Ulster become Northern Ireland in 1921. And the Republic, or the Irish Free State, as now it was known at this point, becomes with the other 26 counties. So where this leaves football is the IFA has been kind of dominating affairs since Ireland started playing international football in 1882. So they had like 38 or so internationals played in Belfast, whereas only six games had taken place at Daly Mount in Dublin. Also, vast majority of players coming from the north, partly because they were better because they had longer established football culture within Belfast than those from the south getting picked. So by this point, you've got the Leinster Football Association in Dublin going, do you know what, let's do our own thing. You know, the country's done its own thing, let's do it as well. And they go and form the Football Association of Ireland, so the FAI. So this is what the Republic of Ireland team, national team is now. And so you have two separate jurisdictions. However, it was there was a lot of cross-border activity as well. So you get incidents, for example, where Alton, who is a team, A-L-T-O-N, a team from Belfast, win the FAI Cup. So that's the one that belongs to the Republic of the Irish Free State at this point. But they were in 1923, so it's only like the second edition of it. So, and they won't, the FAI will not let the cup go north of the new border because they're worried, what might happen. So that trophy didn't go across to the Alton team until the centenary of that event. So 2023, they actually got in touch with descendants and then brought the cup up to Belfast to show them. So it's quite interesting what happened at that point. So it's all very fluid. So it's a sort of, that's cut a very long story short, but I had to sort of, explain that in the book very early on. And this is part of the reason I did the chapters by province. So this is the provinces, there's four provinces, Ulster, Leinster, Munster and Connacht, which is geographically the historical provinces, which the rugby clubs still play as. But I thought, if I'm going to do this, I could do NIFL and then the League of Ireland, but then I would be sort of jumping around a lot. So I did it like that in geography and then break up the other chapters with things such as the history of the international sides and the women's football and Irish pioneers abroad. But your question about Belfast Celtic and Derry City, though, that speak to this sort of sectarian divide, they obviously weren't direct results of the split. It didn't happen around the same time. Belfast Celtic did quit the league in 1920 for the first time. They obviously, as you can tell by the name, were the first sort of Catholic club. In fact, if anything, I'd say Belfast in the 1890s is probably where we see organised football violence, politically motivated football violence for the first time. There was often flares between them and fans of Linfield and Glentoran whenever they sort of like play Crofton together with Protestant clubs. But 1920 is getting too much, so they quit the league and then they rejoined a few years later within Northern Ireland, the IFA jurisdiction. They quit altogether in 1949 after a particularly nasty incident with Linfield fans who stamped on one of their strikers' legs after a particularly controversial game. And that's it. They were so successful, though, they're still the third most successful team in Northern Ireland, even though they haven't played for 76 years now. So with 13 odd titles and 8 IFA Cups. With Derry City, this is much later, this 1972, they had to kind of withdraw from the Irish League because no one played there, frankly. So anyone know anything about Derry or Derry, we should call it. There was, during the Troubles in the late 60s, early 70s, Derry was a flashpoint of that. Obviously, there was the Bloody Sunday massacre in 1972 when British paratroopers shot dead 14 civilians. And so that obviously, clubs didn't really want to go there. There was one visiting team had their Ballymena got their coach was set on fire. And so the league said, well, you play your games at Coleraine, but then they couldn't get fans. So they basically pulled out and played in junior football for about a decade. Some former players got together and very pragmatic, good sort of like compromise, got the AFA, the FAI, UEFA and FIFA to agree to let Derry play in the League of Ireland. And so that way they came south of the border, effectively, and they took to it straight away and they won a double, within a few years of being in that league. So they're still in it. It's a really interesting sort of to go there because it's, because you can imagine because of the history, it's stewarded by club stewards and not, there's no police presence. The police service in Northern Ireland, which is the successor of the Royal Ulster Constabulary, they're not within the ground. It's only stewards. So it's quite, and it's in the, the Brandywell Stadium is just on the edge of the bog side there, which Aidan, you remember, it probably is talked about quite a lot in the news when we were kids, it's one of the sort of more notorious areas. I was very mindful when I went there with my home county accent asking for my ticket and, for the media list. So, it was really fine. It was really interesting sort of occasion, but they're quite powerful at the moment. They're doing quite well in the League of Ireland.
No, it's really fascinating. And Matthew, I think, the way this has been shaped as well in Northern Ireland, I think I find on this particular issue, obviously the Northern Ireland perspective is the one where this resonates and impacts the most. There's a quote that Chris has in that Ulster chapter from someone he spoke to at Linfield about how their dominance, you know, referred to as the most dominant club side in Europe. Is that it?
I think the world.
The most number of titles. The world, okay, even more. But that dominance, he mentions, is shaped by the fact that Belfast Celtic have gone, the hole they left behind, Derry City's exit, clubs of a bigger scale, I guess, than what's been left behind. We're leaving Linfield as the biggest. You know, they're not exactly a giant by other nations' perspective, but in Northern Ireland, they're sort of left on their own. But what I found extra interesting was the fact that he said it was exacerbated by the passion for rugby among the unionist community and the passion for Gaelic sports among the Republican or nationalist community, which it's really interesting the impact that other sports have had on the picture, not just in terms of popularity, which is how it might impact elsewhere, but in terms of far beyond that, I think, in Northern Irish terms.
Yeah, and that's what this book does quite well, in that it's very easy to think about Northern Irish football, and just your mind, the uneducated English mind that I have, goes instantly to everything must be affected by the Troubles, when while that is true, it is also not the whole story. And it's a cliche to say that football is a mirror and a reflection of society, but it feels quite keenly accurate in the instance of Irish and Northern Irish football. It is a mix of, you know, class and what's happened from the Troubles. It's a mix of emigration and immigration, which is a really, really large part of the Irish story. And all of those combine to have this really fascinating situation that we have now, where you have Linfield who are, I mean, I don't think it reflects really well on a sport or a country when you have one team that is so dominant over the rest of, over everything else. But where you have this situation where, you know, Belfast Celtic haven't existed for 70 years, Derry have been forced voluntarily or whichever way you look at it to move and play in a different league. It's a very, very complicated situation, I would say, and one that makes for a really fascinating study. That's what I think the book does quite well in exploring this and explaining this and reflecting on this and, you know, explaining what's come before and, you know, also explaining why there'll be no change to it, because as I think, is it Colin Miller who I really like Colin Miller, his stuff that he does online, points out that it's not just that, but there's also, you know, Europe is a consideration, that there will never be a unification of Ireland in terms of football or soccer, because why would Linfield want to give up one of their, you know, European places that they get so regularly?
Might depend on the wider political situation. I mean,
well, yes.
If there were to be a reunification of the island, then I don't know where that would leave the league. I mean, what are you talking about when they say there'll be no league across the whole island? That's while you're still assuming that there's two separate parts. So you never know, in the future that might change, there might be just one. But with that, yeah, I mean, people did express support for an island-wide cup competition as they've existed in the past, like with Setanta Cup, for example, because it gives them a variety. At the minute in the League of Ireland, you play each other twice at home and twice away. You know, if you're playing four times a season, it kind of, you know, devalues it, but it makes it less of a novelty. Whereas, you know, likewise in Northern Ireland, stuff, you're going to different places. You're going to, like, you know, seeing different teams and you're having different football experiences and seeing different grounds that you wouldn't necessarily do before. So I think there's support for a cup competition. But like you said, they wouldn't cannibalise their own sort of bank balances by sort of, you know, voting against, you know, against having more European places. So that, yeah, European football is massive in terms of prize money, and even just getting through to the, you know, one of a couple of rounds can really sort of, you know, financially sort them out. But one of the things that has shaken things up, and you talk about the dominance of Linfield, and they just won the league again the week that we're recording, I think. But the for the last couple of years, it's been won by Larne, who for the first century didn't really do anything of their existence. And then they got bought by a guy who co-founded Purple Bricks, the property company. And then he funded it and managed it in a really interesting way, a sensible way. And it's just, as it's covered in that chapter, I talked to a podcaster and a fan about that. And it seems like really well run. And they have, you know, a plan in place. They've got a new stadium, new pitch, etc. And they did rise up in a steady way to the point where they won the title and then retained it. So they retained it the season that I was there watching them, and I saw them demolish Glenarvan 4-0 away. So yeah, they did really well. And the Larne is like a small port, and you know, way north of Belfast. But yeah, they obviously didn't maintain that run this year. Linfield sort of back to normal service, you know, resumed really this year. But yeah, a bit of variety would be great. It looks like they're both into that. If not at a league stage, then definitely a sort of all-Ireland cup.
Oh, that would be interesting to see, certainly. Whether it lasts or takes off is another matter. You know, there's been attempts at English and Scottish cups and things like that that have died the death, or English and Italian, dare we say, back in the day. But yeah, that would be interesting. Internationally then, obviously Ireland, when it was all one and the same, was one of the earlier international teams, of course. You know, it's one of the older football cultures. They were ultimately the first foreign national team to beat England in England, which is a fact that gets forgotten about, I'm sure, amidst the Hungary brouhaha of the 1950s. That's when it would already split and become the Irish Free State, or whether that's what we term it now to distinguish, whereas at the time, I think Ireland and Ireland were two separate teams called the same thing in some cases, maybe a bit earlier. But then we had to rename as Northern Ireland for football reasons, and I guess politically too. Now, I recall vividly, Matthew, I don't know whether you're possibly too young for this, the 1994 World Cup qualifiers when the two got pitched together in a qualifying group, and I don't think that's happened before or since. They played other games, but maybe not quite as contentious as those, given the time, the era that it was. But equally, when I was growing up, Northern Ireland were the dominant one by far. Republic of Ireland had good players, but missed out again and again up until 1988. But Northern Ireland had been hugely successful before that, and obviously had the greatest Irish player of them all, who didn't go to a tournament, but you know, he was synonymous with Irish football and making you think of Belfast as the dominant hub. But I guess since that time, they clashed, the tables have turned the other way, and Republic of Ireland have been far more dominant, although I guess neither is particularly strong right now. How is the relationship, and how do you see it, Matthew, as well? You know, maybe coming from your younger eyes than mine, who sees Northern Ireland as a power from the 80s. How do you see the relationship between the two now? And you probably don't recall those clashes in 1993, but you know, it was a big deal at the time. It was, I guess, quite problematic for those in charge. I think it's probably fair to say, but you know, ultimately the Republic of Ireland got the success they needed and went off to the World Cup at Northern Ireland's expense.
Yeah, I'm going to make you feel old now. I was born in 92, so I don't
need any knowledge.
But I've always seen Republic of Ireland especially as a sort of country that underachieves with, you know, when you think about some of the players that they've had over the years, like we've mentioned Damien Duff. I'm going to embarrass myself now and forget every single player that's ever played for them. But, you know, you had the era where you had like the Damien Duff and the Lee Carsleys and that sort of era. They've always had pretty good defenders that have come through, and they've never really been able to capitalise on that. But I think a lot of that comes down to the structure that they've had there with the FIA and, you know, John Delaney and that whole saga that's been going on for, what, how long was that? 10 years? That ended in a slight bit of controversy that if you don't have that structure in place, even if it is international football, you don't have that structure behind you in place, you're not going to be successful. And I think we've mentioned before, but a lot of the story of Ireland is linked to immigration, emigration, and they've probably lost out on a lot of players over the years that have gone on to play for England. We've had a couple in recent years with Declan Rice and Jack Grealish who have represented Ireland first and then left to switch countries to play for England. A lot of players have been missed out on. Northern Ireland is a tricky one. I've sort of passed me by a lot of the years, but I always remember us, England losing, there was a David Healy goal, was that in the 2000s or 2006 or something like that?
2000 years for the 06 qualifiers, yeah.
They've always been sort of the plucky underdogs, I think, compared to a few of the other home nations. But what they did with Michael O'Neill in charge, I thought was pretty tremendous. And that run, I think, was it Euro 2018? I think they were a bit overshadowed by 2016, sorry, they're a bit overshadowed by what Wales did that tournament and didn't get the credit they deserve. But it's pretty fascinating to read about, pretty fascinating to see how old the... Because I have to confess, I had no idea that Ireland were the first foreign team to beat England in England, which is pretty extraordinary. I guess the issue now is when you look at the future, and for both, it's looking better than it has done recently, but still not, I wouldn't say, particularly positive. I know Ireland especially are struggling to get players to come through to stay true to Ireland and not switch allegiances. And Northern Ireland as well. If you look at the lineups when they have their internationals lately, there's a lot of players that haven't even made appearances for their senior appearances for their club side yet, and they're being called up to the Northern Irish team, which never really reflects well. I think the future looks better, but not necessarily as positive as they'd like.
Well, the challenge that Northern Ireland has is if you're born in Northern Ireland, you can qualify for the Republic as well. So, you know, it depends who you want to represent, and of that might depend on your own personal familial background. In terms, just for everyone to know about the rule, if you can qualify for the Republic of Ireland, if you qualify for nationality, which means parent or grandparent. So that has happened. A lot of England players or potential England players from the past, players born in England and Scotland, in the case of Ray Helton, have turned out for the Republic. The challenge there is that therefore be locked in to that particular country after actually played a competitive match. So if you really want to lock down the likes of Grealish and Rice, then you have to put them in a competitive qualifier or something like that rather than a friendly, and then, you know, then you've got them. So, you know, that's possibly one for future sort of talent and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, with the international sides, there hasn't been a fully Irish born 11, I think, since the 70s or 80s from the Republic of Ireland side of things. So they've always relied on overseas players, which is not uncommon anyway. England's always had, you know, foreign born players as well. And Italy in particular, who famously got strong on using oriundi, you know, foreign born players usually of Italian descent. So it's not like uncommon. So it's easy to say, oh, you're loading up with, as Billy Bingham said in that infamous 1993 qualifying match for USA 94, when he called them mercenaries for turning out, you know, for, you know, to play international football. It's not quite as cut and dried in that. It's certainly not unique to the Republic of Ireland. So yeah, when we're saying this the issue with the confusion about Ireland in the 1949 match at Goodison Park when they beat England is that both sides, as you mentioned, were calling themselves Ireland at that time, and it took FIFA to step in and go, right, you are Northern Ireland, you should be, and then do are the Republic of Ireland. That's how we're going to name it from now on, and that's how it stayed. But yeah, with Northern Ireland, like you, Aidan, I grew up at a time when I thought they were good. You know, they were 82 and 86. I thought they were sort of like a global powerhouse, and sort of like God went also downhill. But you know, for a small country, they have. I mean, there's a great stat at the Windsor Park. They've got a very good museum, actually. Or Education and Heritage Centre at Windsor Park. And it's somewhere on there, it says the smallest country to have got through the group stage of the World Cup, won a match and scored a goal or something. And of course, you know, there's some really famous moments like beating Spain and I think it beat Argentina in the 1958 World Cup. So there's been some big moments. Like I said, George Best never quite played. He didn't really have that many appearances for Ireland. I think he's got 39 or something. It's not that many. So it's don't quote me on that. Well, I'm on the record. It's not many. Anyone can sort of research for themselves, but it's not as many as you'd expect, really. I guess they played maybe a little less football in those days. But yeah, so the international scene right now, they're both quite, you know, going through those cycles. I think very much a case of nurturing talent. And what's happening in the League of Ireland, particularly because of Brexit, is that now the young players can't leave to play in UK clubs, so English leagues, Scottish leagues, even in NFL, until they are 18 or unless they have a British parent. So the best talent is staying behind. Now, previously, the really good talent that went abroad would have been developed by English clubs, Scottish clubs, youth systems, and therefore, you know, they've probably got really good coaching, whereas at the minute there's a shortage of coaching, as I cover in the conclusion, in Ireland. So where are those players going to get that sort of coaching from? And I think that's one of the challenges that the Republic, the League of Ireland clubs need to embrace.
I wanted to ask Chris, I know this isn't the main focus of your book, but being an Englishman walking around Ireland, did you get many people wanting to talk to you about Jackie Charlton?
Not really, actually, no. I talked about Jack Charlton once. People, yeah, football's a very unifying language. And some people say, oh, are you going to be safe going to, like, you know, these parts of Belfast or whatever, or Derry? And I was absolutely fine. No one had any comments to me at all, anything like that. If anything, I got offered lifts, bought pints, got given books, scarves, all sorts. I was treated really well. Talks about all sorts of things. I mean, one of the problems with the game in Ireland itself is, and both in League of Ireland and NFL, is the popularity of the Premier League, because that totally affects the turnout of matches, it affects the scheduling of games. That's why really rare to get Sunday matches, for example. Most games happen on a Friday night or a Saturday night, so it's not to clash with 3 p.m. because they can see 3 p.m. games over in the Republic of Ireland. You know, we can't have that here. So that was a bit weird, sitting in a pub watching Forest against Liverpool at 3 p.m. I was like, hang on, something doesn't feel quite right here. But that was like, you know, that's because it clashes. So the Premier League is so dominant. There's so many, I can't remember the exact stats, I've got them in the book, but how many large percentage support either Liverpool, Manchester United or Celtic. But the fact the Premier League is becoming so expensive to follow, you're talking about flights and boats, hotels, etc., match day tickets. Also, a lack of Irish players in the Premier League as well is making it less attractive as a product over there. So people are rediscovering their local product. And that's why one of the reasons the League of Ireland in particular is having a moment, you know, along with other factors such as like social media. They've got a great ultra culture that's kind of sprung up around the turn of the century, places like Shamrock Rovers, and it's kind of copied by each other clubs. So it's very Instagrammable experience going to League of Ireland with flares, tifos, etc., especially when you've got Shamrock Rovers against Bohemians, which is the big derby. And Copper 90, who you know, YouTube channel, went and did a documentary about 2015-16 about it. And that was seen, one of the people I interviewed said that was a moment where people realized that the product they had, they went viral effectively and domestically anyway. And so lots more people started going to games as a result of that. And obviously by word of mouth, your friends saying this is a great experience, they see on social media it's a great experience, they go along with that, with the younger players sticking around. It becomes far more associatable than the Premier League, which is kind of like distant. And even for us, we live here, and for me, I haven't been to a Premier League match since before the pandemic, in fact. Brighton against Villa. So it doesn't appeal to me anymore. I don't want to spend 70 quid to go, you know, there's very, very few clubs in the top flight generate a decent atmosphere. I'd rather be in a smaller ground like Daily Mount with 4,000 other people having a really good time and feeling connected with the players.
I did have that thought reading the book, and I wonder if this is a bit of a vision of the future for, you know, for England as well, where I think it might be quite common for people to have their local team, like whether it's your non-league team or a lower league team that you follow. And also I'm a Birmingham City fan, so maybe if Birmingham City progress with the leagues, maybe I'll have Birmingham City as my, you know, bigger team to support, and I'll be going to my local non-league team on a weekend to have that more authentic experience.
Yeah, I think there's a lot in that. I think the people will get priced out of it, or already are being priced out of it. And such is the popularity overall, and the cash grab that the big clubs are wanting to do, that they are more interested in tourist fans, shall we say, or corporate fans, corporate events. You know, the new stadiums aren't just for giving better seating arrangements and all of this. It's all about more money, isn't it? It's more cash per, more income per spectator rather than season ticket holders are long standing. They're the least valuable to a club in many ways because they're paying less than everybody else per game. They can get much more for the seat. That's why they don't want too many kids going as well, I would imagine, because you don't earn as much for the seat. So yeah, I think there's a lot in what you're saying there, Matthew, of how things may go. We just had
non-league day at the time of recording, and Bradford City, I don't know if you see the pictures from Bradford City, which obviously is, I think, League 2, is it, or League 1? I can't remember. They got 23,000 sell out, and the atmosphere looked incredible. It's like, that's what I'd like to see. A lot of young lower league clubs and non-league clubs need to market themselves better. It's something that annoys me. They're not very good at it. You've got a population that's desperate to watch authentic football in their community, and, you know, people don't necessarily know where to go to get it, or they're not, you know, maybe still a bit sort of like a few men and a dog or whatever. Let's, you know, let's get what you see in Ireland is small clubs that were, again, having very small crowds at one point, but it's been galvanized, it's youthful, it's exciting, it's vibrant, it's colorful, there's non-stop singing. It's like taking inspiration from Germany and Italy, when they've ground hopped over there, but without the criminality of Italian ultras, for example. So it's all the colour and fun basically that goes into it, and it's affordable as well. You're talking about 20 to 25 euros for a ticket, and I'd like to see lower league clubs doing that a bit more in England.
So how is that? You talk about this ultra culture and how it's been growing, and then leads into the marketing of it and all. How has it grown though? Has it been? You look across at, say, MLS or something, and it seems a little, I don't want to say contrived, but it seems like it wasn't there one day and then it was the next. Has it evolved a bit more naturally in Ireland, or do other differences? Obviously, it's a summertime league, the League of Ireland as well. Has that had an impact on fan culture, fan engagement, or attendances as well?
Yeah, definitely. Well, it goes back to the competition with the Premier League, really, and partly the weather. So the League of Ireland runs between February and November, and the Irish League in the north runs say parallel with the British League. So it go like between August and sort of April, May. So yeah, the League of Ireland is a summer league, predominantly. It's obviously winter and autumn as well. But
summer's quite a stretch, isn't it?
Well, the thing is, it's... I mean, the ultra started coming around, like I said, with the SRFC ultras, claimed to be the first thing, Shamrock Rovers in the sort of turn of the 2000s. And they were quite nomadic at the times before they moved to Tallaght. So it's very much a very organic movement. The other clubs kind of started copying them. Like I said, people got experience of ground hopping in Europe, seeing what they like what they see, sorry, in Germany and places like that, started getting hold of flares and starting to make their own sort of banners and TIFOs and things like that. Some of which are quite creative. So there's one, I think the Shamrock Rovers told me about, where they put the Bohemians, they had a big toilet in their banner, and then they would roll down the Bohemians team sheet as a piece of paper that went down into the toilet bowl. So there's a lot of element of wit with it. So a lot of the songs as well will be familiar to us, but there's some other ones that you wouldn't necessarily know. So there's that stadium terrace wit that goes with it as well. And so they're taking elements from all the cultures they've been exposed to and created something sort of unique and local to it. So that was, once they started it, then other clubs said, right, we want an ultra group as well. And they start their own one. And eventually it's becoming almost like a competition to set who's going to outdo each other. However, that has kind of brought them into conflict with the authorities ever so often. There was unfortunate incidents a couple of times last season where flares made it onto the pitch, and you don't want that, and especially you don't want it if it hits a player, which did happen once, and also you don't want it landing on an artificial pitch because that's very expensive. So they do get fined for things being thrown on the pitch. But of course, I think it's just a question of finding the right balance where it's you can bring the colour and bring the noise without it being a danger to anybody.
Okay, excellent. And we mentioned at the start, Chris, your blog and podcast are about ground hopping largely, as well as football culture. So we talked a bit about the culture, but in terms of ground hopping, how easy is it to be a ground hopper in Ireland or both of the Irish leagues? Probably attendance wise, not that hard. And you've talked about, being a home county's Englishman going, and it hasn't been an issue in general. Is it a good place for such an activity?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think you have to plan ahead, the fixture list wise. You can buy your tickets online like you can pretty much anywhere now. The only thing is you'll have demand at the Daily Mount in particular, Bohemians Ground, as it's in its very last year. So it's often better if you know someone at some of the time of these places. So again, the day won't go on, you'll give the fixture list, but they won't go on sale necessarily until, a few weeks beforehand. So if you know where you're going, you know where you want to be based, that's quite handy. The challenge is, like I mentioned, they don't have there is some Sunday football. I was pulled up on this by someone. There is, in Northern Ireland especially, there's Sunday women's football and junior football. There's not usually not men's football. It's not outlawed. It was outlawed until 2008 or something, but they allow Sunday now at the club's discretion. But doesn't quite often, the men's senior doesn't tend to happen on a Sunday. So if you're planning it, Friday night, get a game in somewhere, Saturday afternoon, even you can get Saturday lunchtime and perhaps an evening kickoff if there's two games in Belfast, for example. So in the Irish League. Within League of Ireland, there's several clubs in Dublin. Again, they all kick off on the Friday night. So what I tended to do, it's quite interesting. Some clubs play on Saturday night, such as Sligo Rovers, which is well worth a visit, and Longford Town, partly because a lot of their population work in, say, Dublin, for example, during the week, and would kind of be driving back on a Friday night. So it's very much a case of check the fixture lists as to where you are, but you should be able to get a couple of games in, men's senior games anyway, in over a weekend, and see what else is going when you look at like the Footballogy app or something like that and find out what games you got going on. In terms of price, in NIFL, it's really cheap. It's like, I think it was capped at £13 a couple of seasons ago, so you wouldn't be paying much more than that now. And in the League of Ireland, you're looking at 20, 25 euros, to be honest. Very, very accessible.
Where would you be heading, Matthew, then, if you got the chance?
Well, I've always been quite fascinated by Bohemians. I think that would be one. I know you just mentioned this, just the one you mentioned is difficult to get to, but they are a club that I've had my eye on for a while. They're quite fascinating, progressive club. They seem to have voiced a lot of opinions that I agree with, and it seems like a very welcoming environment from people of all backgrounds. You know, the whole refugees welcome campaign, staging a match between Bohemian women's and Palestine women's national team. And the fact that they are, correct me if I'm wrong, member-owned still, means that it's even more reflective of the community around them. It means that the stuff that they're doing, this welcome environment and the messages they're sending is reflective of that area of Ireland. So I think that's a pretty fascinating club, and one I'd love to visit. That would be great.
You forgot to mention they've got a climate officer and a resident poet.
Well, that's just fantastic. Absolutely perfect. That would be absolutely fascinating to go visit.
Yeah, no, I'm a big. I like what Beams are doing as well. I mean, it's nice that there's space for that, and it is a long tradition. As a point in that piece, it's not just a modern fad. They've been supporting right back since when they're supporting the suffragettes back in the sort of 1920s, the Irish equivalent of the suffragettes in the 20s. So they have a long history of activism and being fan owned. So all power to them there. But like I said, they're getting a new ground, which I think at the moment, anywhere between, I think it's 8,000, but could it be up capacity their new ground? Maybe even 10, don't quote me on that, but I think 8 at least. So it'll be easier to get in the future. But what I like about Daily Mail, and I hope they keep this charm, is it's got lots of amazing murals around the place. Yeah, one to Jack Charlton, one to Bob Marley, who played there, and Thin Lizzy, who played there as well. So you've got Phil Lynott, who's obviously a bit of a local hero. So, you know, they've got, you know, and lots of anti-fascist sort of graffiti as well. So it's kind of, I think it's a very characterful ground. It's a bit of a shame that it's going to be modernized, but I just hope they get the balance right and that some of that ethos will definitely remain, because the fans are kind of going to, you know, bring it. But yeah, definitely a really characterful club.
Oh, magnificent. Well, this is a sneak peek into the kind of insight that this book brings. Obviously, there's an awful lot of historical context and lots of the acronyms, IFA, FAI, and all of that. You'll get your head around it all by reading this book. Before we finish up, though, Chris, I often like to finish such podcasts with a few quick fire things to lob your way. So, here we go.
Go on.
Favorite ground you've visited?
Oh, it's the Oval. Island. Oh, my goodness. The Oval is wonderful.
The best fans or the most obscure football chant?
The best fans were definitely the notorious Boo Boys at Bohemians that I saw anyway. Big shout to the Shells Brigade Dig as well. I don't know if I've pronounced that correctly, but my favorite tune that I heard was something by Waterford fans. It was set to the Woody Guthrie's "This Land Is Your Land," which is not, I've not heard before.
Oh, fabulous. Okay, your Irish club of choice, Chris, and I'm going to let you pick two, one right from each league.
Well, so Northern Ireland, it's going to have to be Glentoran because of the Oval. And I was really torn in the League of Ireland as well between Bohemians, just because of the ethos, but also Sligo Rovers, which has got the most magnificent setting with the Ben Bulben Table Mountain in the background. The club are really, really accommodating for me, and they've got a great connection with Everton as well due to Dixie Dean and Seamus Coleman.
Okay, fabulous. And finally then, any other football-related places to visit other than a ground that piqued your interest? I know you've talked about various museums and so on, and you've mentioned murals at Bohemians. There's, I guess, Belfast is well known for murals, and there's a few George Best-related things around the vicinity. What would you suggest to people?
I would suggest going to George Best's house if you can. It's open to the you can actually rent it to stay in, but they do tours there. The East Side Partnership in Belfast do tours if there's no one in there, I think. That's fascinating. They've done it out like it was in the sort of 1960s when they first kind of would have lived in there before he moved to Manchester United in the 50s, sorry. And it was kind of when I went in there, I was like, oh my goodness, just like my nan's house. And it was just, you know, because it's got that aesthetic, it takes you back in time. Yeah, that and Dundella, which is football related, I'm afraid. Dundella, Wilker Park, is a wonderfully characteristic ground. And it's slopey and wobbly, and it's just wonderful. And both, by the way, just factoids, both Dundella's Wilker Park and the Oval Glentoran feature in the Bert Trautmann biopic, The Keeper, because they're so old school, they managed to sort of double up as, well, Dundella's ground was St Helens AFC, and Glentoran's Oval was Main Road to the entrance gate. So if you watch the biopic, keep an eye out for those grounds.
Interesting. Okay. Well, excellent. Well, this book, Shades of Green by Chris Lee, covers all of these aspects and much, 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 much more about the football culture, history, and present of the island of Ireland. Just to throw out some names that we haven't even covered, particularly today, of the rich heritage of football there. We mentioned George Best, I suppose, but, you know, Pat Jennings, Danny Blanchflower, played in the World Cup and all that in the 50s. You could then come to what me and Chris remember for Gerry Armstrong and his iconic moments in the 1980s for the Republic. There's the likes of Johnny Giles and Liam Brady, who never got to play at a tournament either. Some of the best players to have come from there. But you can then come more modern, of course, to Roy Keane, Robbie Keane, and all of their feats. There's been some stunningly good players, even if the overall strength isn't the same as much bigger nations, but what would you expect? You know, I think they have their peaks and troughs, as you would imagine, but an awful lot of rich footballing heritage, some phenomenally good players, and more importantly, from this book and this perspective, rich history, great fan culture, and some very, very interesting clubs. So I highly recommend this book. Matthew talked to how much he enjoyed reading it earlier on. Well, I totally agree. So excellent work, Chris. Well done. Congratulations. It is out there for everybody. So go to all the usual places or your independent retailer of choice, even better, to try and get yourself a copy. But thank you very much. Cheers, Matthew, first of all, for joining us. Terrific chat on a great subject.
Yeah, it's been fascinating. I have to add on to your little list of stuff. I thought my favorite tidbit from the book was the Basque 11 versus the League of Ireland 11, which I thought was because I think there's quite a lot of links between the Basque country and Ireland, and I think that's a pretty fascinating slice of history right there. But yeah, congrats on the books, Chris. It was a great read.
Thank you very much. Yeah,
thank you very much, Chris. Cheers for coming on. Brilliant book.
Brilliant. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Okay, then, well, we shall leave things there. Thank you very much both. And please do join us again on the Lob podcast from These Football Times. Thank you and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.